Anyway, I was taught by my sponsors that if I said that I would be somewhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would be there, and I would be there on time. And I would try and look as good as I could. It didn't even mean wearing shoes in the early years, but, you know, I would just show up. And I have always done that throughout the years that I've been sober, even when I've been a flake in all kinds of other areas. And I'll tell you something. When I talk about the way that I felt about myself before getting sober, again, like Bob shared last night, you know, it wasn't like I suddenly walked into AA, took a 30-day chip, and just loved myself. Thought, oh, I'm just wonderful now. You know, I hated everything about myself as much sober as I ever had. You know, and it took years and years and years, and I've still got a lot of work, I'm sure, that I'm getting through. But the very first time that I ever felt any tiny bit of self-worth or self-respect was somewhere after I was 4, 5, 7 years sober, and somewhere in my heart or in my mind, it occurred to me that I was a pretty good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the first good thing I ever felt about myself in my life. Now, I'll tell you, when you walk in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I did, and you don't want to look in mirrors, and you don't want to take baths, and you don't want to take showers, and you don't let people hug you or shake your hand because you hate yourself so much that you can hardly go on, and if someone was to walk up to you at that point and say to you, now look, if you set up chairs every Thursday night for the next 5 years, no matter what, whether you got another date, whether you got a headache, whether you don't feel well, you're just there every Thursday night, and you set up these chairs, in 5 years you're going to like yourself. I mean, who's going to believe that? You know, I mean, it's not to do with setting up chairs. I mean, we all know you got to go to beauty school. You know what I mean? You got to get a face, you know, plastic surgery so that you look like someone else, dye your hair, you know. And just those kind of things. That's what's going to make you feel better about yourself. And the funny thing is that I credit the way I feel about myself today with setting up chairs, washing coffee cups, and showing up when I don't want to. And it doesn't make any sense at all. And most of the things in Alcoholics Anonymous don't. You know, kind of like what Ken was saying. You know, I mean, they don't, it just is. You know, and that's what I believe has happened. In those early months of my sobriety, as I said, I really, I did not begin to like myself. I'd sit in these meetings, and I would listen to people share, and they would share about having lost their self-worth or their self-respect or never having any, like I felt that, was my situation. And then they would say that somewhere along the line, as they worked the steps and they showed up and they did the things that were asked of them in Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere along the line they were able to get out there and they were able to walk on the sunny side of the street. Sort of like Venora was talking yesterday, they were able to look people right in the eye. You know, not just people in AA, all God's kids. You know, they were just able to look them right in the eye. And they didn't feel better then, and they didn't feel less than. They just felt equal. And I absolutely could not imagine that. You know, I wasn't even sure I wanted to feel equal. That didn't sound that good, you know. But the I part sounded kind of interesting, you know. And I didn't think that would ever happen for me. And then they'd say that sometimes they could look themselves in the mirror and say, you know, I love you, and feel like they were their own best friend or something. And I knew that could never, ever happen for someone like me. But I did believe in the hope here in Alcoholics Anonymous anyway. And I believed that maybe if I went to hundreds and hundreds of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe if I never said no to an AA request, maybe if I always showed up and I really tried really, really, really hard, that maybe someday when I walked by one of those big mirrors in a store or when I caught a glimpse of myself in a mirror, maybe someday I wouldn't feel nauseous when I saw what was looking back. And that was enough hope to keep me coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 11 months sober, a bunch of people from my home group got all together and they were going to the International Convention in San Francisco. And it was, you know, you pile 17 people in a car for 4, you know, that kind of thing. And we went to this conference and we pulled up, and my mom being an alcoholic, I'd grown up in a lot of hotels and motels in my life, but I'd never seen anything like the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. And we pulled, I wasn't even wearing shoes yet, you know, I was 11 months sober. We pulled up at this hotel and I couldn't believe it. They had people who were going to park the car. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And everybody just piled down and they go, okay, we're at the AA convention. And I said, I'm not going in there. And they said, no, come on, this is where the convention is. I said, I can't go in there. And it took them a couple hours to convince me to go into this hotel. I mean, I looked inside this hotel. There were long red velvet drapes and big, beautiful chandeliers. There were women in there wearing long dresses. The men were wearing suits, and it was daytime, for Christ's sakes, you know? I mean, I just knew that, you know, if I walked through there, that someone from the hotel staff was going to come over, and they were going to say, excuse me, I'm really sorry, but this is a nice place. This is for nice people. You're from Venice, right? I mean, you know, we don't want your kind in here. And I didn't want to embarrass myself, and I didn't want to embarrass my friends by putting them through that. And in my mind, I snuck into that hotel, and I hid up in the room. It's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever been to, and I've been to hundreds. I never went to one meeting at that conference. I just kind of hid in the room. Once I snuck out and went down and walked around Skid Row, where I felt a little bit more comfortable, you know. And that was it. And that's sort of how I felt about myself, even after. And that's at 11 months sober. But there was still hope in my life. There was still a little bit of hope. And I'm not one of those people who stayed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I was afraid of going out on the streets and dying. I had tried to die as long and as hard as I possibly could. I stayed in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have stayed in the hard times that have come my way, as they come to all of us, you know, because I didn't want to go out there and live that way anymore. That's what I couldn't stand. I couldn't stand living the way that I did. I couldn't have hated myself one thousandth of an inch more by the time I got through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't have done it and gone on. Just couldn't do it. You know, and I had to stay here. Let's see. After I'd been sober for a little while, a couple of years, I got a chance to go to school and learn how to be a secretary. My sponsors kind of arranged it. If there's anything in my life I never wanted to be, it was a secretary. There are very few tough broads that grow up to be secretaries, and I still wanted to be a tough broad more than that, you know, more than anything else, because I still didn't want people to be able to hurt me. And I was having a very hard time staying sober and making sure that people didn't get too close. You know, on an emotional level, it's hard to do around here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was able to, you know, kind of work on it a little bit. I started this school, and through a series of different circumstances, I ended up to be able to go on, and I ended up taking a test so that I could get an equivalent to a high school diploma. And I went on into the world, and I went ahead and started to go to school at night while I worked full time. And I just sort of showed up. And at that point in time, I'd been sober a few years, 4 or 5 years, I don't know, something like that, maybe a little less than that. And I'd been taught to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and to show up for my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that there weren't any excuses that were going to fly. I just had to show up. I didn't have to set up the chairs with a happy attitude. I slammed, you know, 417 chairs down on Thursday nights. I counted them. 1, 2, you know, but I set them up, you know. And at that point, I started to do that in school. I started to show up when I was tired, when I knew the teacher was going to be really boring, you know. I mean, all this kind of thing. I just had learned to just show up. I mean, it was a habit. I didn't even mean to do it, really. And then I tried to do exactly the assignments that they said, and I just kept showing up. And after a couple years, they called me in. They announced that I was graduating from college with what they called an AA degree. I thought that was a great name for a college degree, you know. I never even wanted a college degree. And I hadn't missed any days of school in 3 years. It took me 3 years to get the two-year degree, you know. But, I mean, I hadn't missed any days. And when I walked down to graduate, they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 475 students. And that was the same person. That's the same person that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous that would stand at the door and couldn't remember which name was hers. And couldn't read one sentence in the big book, and would read it over and over and over and over again. And I just went to lots and lots of meetings and showed up and tried to do what was asked of me here. You know, I went ahead and I continued with school after that. And after a couple more years, I graduated the university, and I had had this dream. And my sponsors, as I mentioned, were pretty practical. They were the kind of people that told me that absolutely any dream can come true here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that in order for it to happen, I had to do all the same footwork that anyone in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous had to do. And that if I wanted to do something, I better find out what other people did and start doing it. You know, if I wanted to be president of General Motors, I better start finding out what other presidents of General Motors had done. I better not just sit around my club waiting for God to call and offer me a job at General Motors. They didn't think that was going to happen. And I don't think that means they weren't spiritual, you know. And so I went ahead and I found out about this work, and I did all this footwork for this dream that I had. And I got a telegram, it's been 9 years ago now, telling me that I'd been accepted as one of 300 out of 3,000 applicants to go to law school. Now, I'll tell you, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had always planned on spending a lot of time in court. But never on that side of the table. And I was able to go to law school. And law school was a very interesting experience in a lot of different ways. It was where I learned, for me, and I'd been sober, let's see, I started in 80. So I've been sober about 8 years when I started law school. And I still, at that point, did not, I didn't have a comprehension of everybody as God's kids. I really kind of still thought that, you know, that there were less thans and better thans and, you know, and all these different things. I still wasn't equal. Still didn't know about being equal, you know. And I went to this law school and I was intimidated as hell, you know, because I knew when there were better thans and less thans, I knew which group, you know, I was going into, you know. And I had to deal with some of my old ideas. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous as the worst, one of the worst snobs of anyone I have ever met. Now, you know, you may think that that means, you know, that I had a lot of nice things and I didn't like anybody that didn't. Well, I was kind of the opposite of that. I had never had any nice things and I hated everybody who did. Absolutely hated them. I did not like people who were married. My mother had never been married. I never had a father. And if you were married, I didn't like you. And if your parents were married, I didn't like you either because you didn't know what I'd been through. Now, if you had jewelry, I didn't like you. I didn't have jewelry. We never had jewelry, so why should I like you? You didn't have the same life I'd had. You had jewelry, you know. My mom did not get a car until I was 9, and most of the time after that, we still didn't have a car, and so I didn't like you if you had a car. Now, you think about that. Even in 1972, if you don't like people who are married, have cars, or wear jewelry, that covers a lot of people in or out of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. There were very few speakers that were able to touch me back then, you know. And I was just a snob. Now, when I had been sober somewhere around this time, my sponsor got a new baby. And Linda, who some of you know, is and was one of the most physically, and inside too, but one of the most physically beautiful women I've ever seen. She looks kind of like that crystal woman on one of those shows. Anyway, the real pretty blonde woman. But anyway, she just is absolutely gorgeous. Now, Linda grew up in Santa Barbara with a mother and a father who loved her very much in a beautiful big house. Linda has rarely driven anything lower than a Jaguar. You know, I mean, on her bad days, she takes the Jag, you know. She has every kind of jewelry you could possibly imagine. She is the most elegant, sophisticated dressing woman I've ever known. Just unbelievable, okay? Now, she gets sober. Fine. It's not my business, you know. And she asks my sponsor to be her sponsor. It's like, I don't have any problem with that. Then my sponsor says to me, I want you to be Linda's friend. I mean, I'm not sure I'm willing to go to those lengths. You know, I mean, why does she need a friend? I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, you'd see this woman walk into a meeting and they would line up like she was the speaker to welcome her. You know, I mean, what does she need a friend for? And I didn't like her. I didn't know her, but I didn't like her. I could just look at her and know that I didn't like her. She hadn't lived, you know. I mean, I knew that she had never spent the night on the beach trying to act tough when she was cold. I knew that, you know. And I mean, just looking at her. And I knew she'd never suffered like I suffered. Because very few people, I didn't think there were anybody in the world that had suffered like I suffered because I had that self-centered self-obsession that the book tells us that we have, and I was terminally unique. But anyway, so my sponsor said, well, you know, I want you to be her friend. I said, I don't want to be her friend. And my sponsor said, you know, June, she said, I absolutely cannot believe you. She said, has it ever occurred to you that when a person is in a hotel room in Paris and they try and kill themselves, that they feel exactly the same feelings as a person who's in an alley in Venice does when they try and do it? I thought, well, no. And then she hung up and I had to become Linda's friend. So, anyway. And Linda has been one of my very closest friends since that time. And I started to learn from her that it didn't matter where we came from, you know, in here, and as far as how our feelings were. And that it didn't mean that Linda didn't have all the same feelings that I had just because she had a lot of good things on the outside, you know, going on for her. Because she didn't see them. You know, I mean, she was missing them all in that the way that only the self-centered, you know, alcoholic can do. Anyway, and we became very good friends. And I started to learn a little bit from her. I started to kind of believe in this God's kids idea. And Linda helped me, just knowing Linda, helped me a little bit when I went into law school. Because these people were very much, I mean, they dressed like, you know, kind of like Linda did. And they all had the perfect hairstyle. And they all wore the perfect makeup. And they knew exactly the right thing to wear at the right time, you know. And just all those kind of things. And they were very smart and knew it and told you about it constantly, you know. And I kind of showed up. And it was very, very hard because I was sure that maybe I really didn't belong there. And And that, you know, that this was another little joke of God's, because I really believed in a sense of humor, God having a sense of humor, and I just thought this one may have gone a little too far, you know, put me here. But anyway, I started to learn that they were God's kids, and that they all had feelings, that these people, you know, had feelings, even though they had a mother and a father, you know, I mean, they really had, they had problems too, and all these kind of things. So, and I started to get friends, and I started to just be myself, to be the person that Alcoholics Anonymous had taught me to be, you know. And I started to learn that that I had been given a great gift in Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a sense of humor. And it's a little warped, though, I kind of learned. Everybody doesn't quite share it. And Lee came up to me last night and asked me to kind of tell this this little story about what happened when I was in law school. Well, I started to, you know, to just being myself, I was making a lot of jokes that very few people were laughing at. Which doesn't really bother us. We all know that. You just laugh a little louder at your own. But anyway, I started to realize in law school, you know, that we have, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a lack of judgment that goes on here. You know, I mean, Vinoy was talking yesterday, you know, about that. I'm pretty sure it was Vinoy. She was saying, we love you, but then we judge a little bit, but then we move over here, and then the group that was judging you last week, they're your best friends this week, and they're over there judging. You know, we just kind of changed and whatever. But you know... Really, what most of us, you know, I think that they stick around for a while is we experience whatever we were judging you for, and that kind of helps us to, you know, to go on the other side there for a while. But anyway, I knew that there was kind of this lack of judgment and this acceptance, and it didn't really matter where you were. Sort of like Pat was sharing the other night, you know, I mean, God, how sick are you? You know, can you bottom this? I mean, those are the people we love the most. Oh, God, you know, did this, lost three families, you know, shot everyone in the whole world, and then he drank again. Oh, God, you know, and you laugh. It's just hysterical. So anyway, I was talking to this one guy in law school, and he was very square. He was from behind the Orange Curtain in Orange County, and... he had a mother and a father, you know, that loved him, and he got a car when he turned 16, you know, and just all that stuff, and very square. And so we were standing there, and we were talking, and he said, you know, I just saw this great movie, The Rose, about Janis Joplin. And I said, really? I didn't even think this guy would know who Janis Joplin was. And he says, oh, he says, you know, I've always idolized Janis Joplin. I said, really? He said, yes. He said, I just think she's wonderful. He said, but there's this one part about this movie that really bothered me. I said, well, what was that? So there's this part in this movie where Janis is about to have an affair with this man. And before they have this affair, she turns to him and she says, I have a confession to make. She says, I want you to know that when I was in high school, I slept with the entire high school football team. And this guy at law school says to me, he says, you know, if that's true about Janis, he says, I just don't think I could ever respect her again. And I looked at him and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And this guy didn't sit next to me for the next 2 years, you know, of law school. I didn't even go to high school. You know, what do I know about the high school football team? But anyway, I want to talk about a couple more things. When I got to this program, I was single. And I suppose if you're 13, that's a pretty good idea. But I didn't think so. Because as I've already told you, I really knew that people who were married never had any problems and lived happily ever after. So I sort of thought that would be an answer. Anyway, but since I was 13, I wasn't married yet. And I had to stick around Alcoholics Anonymous and be single. Now, if that happens for you, Ken was kind of sharing about that, but, you know, it means that you're going to probably have to learn to date. Now, I hate dating. I've always hated dating. I'd much rather fall in love, and usually do. I mean, that's the kind of person I am. You know, wait at a coffee pot, I fall in love. And if he comes to the meeting the next night with another woman, I think he's being unfaithful, you know. So, anyway, but if you're single in Alcoholics Anonymous, at least out in L.A., this is pretty big. You're probably going to have to go out on an AA date. I don't know if you have those here. AA dates where a guy asks you out, and then he takes you to a meeting. Where else would you go? You know. Then after the meeting, you go to coffee, and you talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. You know. I had a number of these dates. One of the more interesting ones was when I was out with this guy and we were at the coffee stage of our date. He said, I really like you. And I said, thank you. I really like you a lot. I said, well, thank you very much. He said, but I like your girlfriend over at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? And I'm a tough brat. So I said, oh, no, fine. So he went home and he went over there and I went home and thought things through. And my sponsors have been able to convince me over the years that I never have had a problem yet that's been as bad as my solution for it, but I'm still, when I have a really bad problem, my mind tells me what you need to do is go into a room and think things through. I've never come out feeling better yet, but I'm sure that this will, you know, don't answer the phone, don't talk to anybody about this, just think it through. So I went home that night, I thought things through, I came up in the morning and I had the answer, the only answer that could possibly work for someone like me, and I went down that morning and tried to join the United States Air Force, and they wouldn't take me, and then I called my sponsor, and that's what I would recommend. If the Air Force won't take you, then you might want to try calling your sponsor, you know. Now, somewhere around in this period of time, in the early years of my sobriety, I got emotionally involved, and then, you know, we didn't even make it to a 30-day chip, you know, and We broke up. He broke up with me. And I was sitting there and I was feeling pain that I had never felt in my life. Because I never got anywhere near emotionally involved with anyone before or after I got in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew that I could be absolutely destroyed on an emotional level. You know, and very few people in Alcoholics Anonymous had tried to punch me in the face. So I didn't have a lot of contact with people. You know, that was the only kind of contact I was used to. So I didn't know what to do, and I sat there, and you know, I had a hard time when I started to go out with this guy. You see, I always thought you should either have a higher power or a boyfriend. And I thought it was really selfish when people had boyfriends that they would talk to the higher power, because I had a lot of things to say to him. You know, I had to explain what kind of boyfriend I needed and why I needed a boyfriend and that sort of thing. And so I thought that if they had a boyfriend, they should just leave God alone, you know, because I had to talk to him. So when I had this boyfriend, then I thought it was a lot easier to talk to him than to God, because he answered back, you know. And so I really wasn't working on this spiritual higher power stuff, you know, because I had a boyfriend. And so then we broke up. And so I was sitting there and I certainly couldn't talk to a higher power, because I wasn't working on that at all. And here I was and the boyfriend was gone. There wasn't anybody to answer me back. And I sat there and I thought things through, and I figured that the only answer was I was going to have to kill myself, because I thought, I can't stay sober and feel like this. I mean, I never felt pain like this, even when I was out there. I can't feel emotional pain like this. I don't know how to do this. And then there was a knock at my door. So I got up and I opened the door, and there was this guy named Bob, and he said, hi. He said, are you ready to go? I said, what are you talking about, Bob? He said, well, remember I told you a couple weeks ago the central office had asked us to go over to this high school and talk to these people a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said you'd go with me. And I said, Bob, experience, strength, and hope I don't have right now. I said, I was just going to go in the bathroom and kill myself. He said, really? He said, have you had dinner? And I said, no. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, let's go get something to eat. He said, then I'll take you over to the school. You don't have to say anything. He said, I'll just talk for a little while, then I'll bring you home and you can kill yourself. And I said, okay. So we went. And I want you to know that as we went to the school, I wouldn't talk to Bob and I wouldn't let him play the radio. See, because if you start to talk to somebody, you could start to feel better. And you don't want that to happen. So I was deep in thought. I was very deep in thought. I was thinking about how much pain I was in, how we, you know, this was, it was over. And if you're going to feel the maximum amount of pain, which is why you can't talk to anybody when you're in this kind of place, then you have to concentrate on the fact that not only has this relationship failed, but there will never be anyone else again. And if you don't focus on that, you're really missing the maximum amount, you know. So I was deep in thought, and we pulled up at this school, and I was just wandering along, just kind of dazed in my pain, and this total stranger walked up to me and said, excuse me, do you know where room 314 is or something? And I said, no. She said, well, would you help me find it? Oh, Jesus. Here I am, I'm in incredible pain, you know. And this absolute stranger wants me to help her find a room in a school I've never been to. I thought, oh, fine. And I took her around, got her lost. And and we started talking. She started talking because I wasn't talking. I was in pain. But she started talking. She said, what kind of class are you taking? I said, I'm not really taking a class. I answer very succinctly when I'm, you know, no, nothing extra. She said, you're not? She said, well, what are you doing here? I said, I came with some people and we're going to talk a little bit about alcoholism. She said, really? For it or against it? So I guess you'd say against it. You know, I never really heard of any talks for alcoholism, you know. She said, I'm on the wagon. And I said, that's wonderful. I've known a lot of people on the wagon. They usually fall off. I said, but that's great. She said, well, why would you be giving that kind of a talk? And I said, because I'm an alcoholic, and I stay sober one day at a time through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to go to a meeting sometime? And she said, yes, she would. And we traded phone numbers, made arrangements to go to a meeting the next night. Obviously, I couldn't go home and kill myself. She'd think AA didn't work. next night I picked Kay up and I took Kay to lots and lots of meetings. And Kay did not stay sober at that time, but I did. And today Kay is sober. She took a cake for 14 years this past August. And Kay has every bit as much to do with my being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today as I've had to do with her being one, you know. And I realized later what it says in the big book when it says, when all else fails, which it has a number of times, try working with another alcoholic. Try working with another person who's sicker than you are. And I don't necessarily believe that that means it has to be a newcomer. You know, if you can't find a newcomer handy, then go to the hospital where you've got one of the members that's, you know, like Ken was sharing about, you know, that isn't having a lot of visitors right now because they're not telling a whole lot of funny stories and sometimes people forget to drop by anyway, you know. Or just kind of listen in the meetings and kind of look around and see the people that are going through some things that are just kind of tough. They're tough whether you're in AA or you're out. And just kind of go over and just say hi, you know, not for anything else maybe. Maybe get their number and send them a card once in a while and just kind of, you know, that sort of thing. And that's what I have tried to learn to do, and that's what I try and tell my babies to do when they're in that when all else fails. And it's what I hope that they tell me to do. Because when all else is failing, that's all I see and hear about is, you know, it's just all failing. Anyway, I went on after that and I ended up getting emotionally involved again, believe it or not, and later on. And this was the this is around when I met Cliff and Pat and they took me into, you know, to their home and with their five kids and the, you know, and kind of let me be part of their family for a long, long time now. But I was dating this guy, and this guy was the most handsome man I had ever seen in my life. He was unbelievable, and I couldn't believe he would ask me out. Because, I mean, he was so gorgeous. He really was just drop-dead gorgeous. And he asked me out. And then we went out, like, over and over and over, and we kept going out. And it was unbelievable, because I knew that no one would like that would ever want me. You know, and I was, like I said, I was a few years sober at this time. And after, it was the day of our 30-day chip, the, you know, he left me for a younger woman. And I knew at that time that God had played the cruelest joke that he had ever played on me, and I was tired of it. I was done. And it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 years sober, and it was the hardest experience that I have ever been through in the years that I was sober. I felt that this man had, that God had tricked me. Because I knew I wasn't any good, and I knew nobody good would ever want me, and I knew nobody would ever want anything to do with me that was, you know, ever cute or handsome or wonderful. And then this guy started asking me out, and he asked me out like a bunch of times for 30 days, and I started to think maybe it could happen here. And then he dumped me. And I just felt like it was this big joke. It's like, June, who are you kidding? Why would he ever want you? You know, look at you. And I'd go look in the mirror and I'd say, look at you. You wonder why he didn't stay. You should be lucky he ever asked you out ever. You know, because I was still dealing with all those feelings of who I was and where I came from, you know. And I went through this period of time where I didn't want to talk to God anymore. And I didn't want to talk to my sponsor anymore. And I went to meetings and I did not want to cry because this guy was in AA. And so was this other woman. And they might see that I felt pain. And I was not going to let him know that I was absolutely in the most pain that I had ever been in my life. And I found at that point in time in my life that I had a very serious choice, and it's one that many of us make, I guess, much, much earlier in the program, you know, and maybe Bob was right when he said that sometimes if we get here young, we don't make that that conscious, you know, decision until a little bit later point. I don't know. But at that point in time, I realized that I had a choice to make in my sobriety. I had to choose to give up my old ideas, or I had to drink. Because I could not continue to be the person I had always wanted to be, the person who didn't care, the person who couldn't get hurt, the person that never let anyone know that I was hurting. I couldn't be that person and stay sober. And I'd like to tell you it was a very easy decision, but it really wasn't. Because all my life, all I'd ever wanted to be was to be tough. It was all I ever wanted to be. I knew it was the only way I could get through the world. And I knew that if I started to be who I was around here, that I would just get cut to ribbons. Not just in AA, I mean, I knew people in AA weren't going to be cruel, but I was going to have to go out there in the world with the wolf pack, you know, and I knew they were just going to tear me apart. And my sponsor kept trying to explain to me that there was a difference between being tough and being strong. And I knew she didn't understand. She was from the South. She wore pink. You know, she didn't understand it. When I took my cake last year for 16 years, I wore this little pink dress and this little pink and white hat. I had pink shoes. And I walked up there to take the cake, and I was as strong as I have ever been in my life, and I am today. The fascinating thing about that is there are more people in the world that can hurt my feelings and make me feel bad than there ever have been. Because there are more people who love them and who I love and who know that I love them. I mean, it's just no big secret anymore, you know. And if I was to get down from here and, you know, and Cliff was to say, I don't like you and I don't ever want to have anything to do with you again, I mean, it would just tear me apart. Now, I don't suspect that that's going to happen, you know, but it would hurt a lot, and Cliff knows that, and that's why he wouldn't do it. You know, and if when Vinoy and I are getting on that plane, she said, I don't want to sit next to you, even though we're on the same plane, you know, it would hurt my feelings, and Vinoy knows that, you know, and she wouldn't do it. And that doesn't mean that as I walk out there in the world that everybody's going to say, oops, I don't want to hurt June's feelings, because that ain't true, let me tell you. And the book says the world and its people are quite often wrong, and I've got a number of situations I could share with you about when they have been. But I'm not tough anymore, and I've learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous from other people's example, but I'm stronger than I have ever been. You know, when I was around 5 years sober, I was sitting at a banquet and I was looking around the room comparing myself to everyone else in the room. And I suddenly realized that I didn't want to be wearing anyone else's dress. That I didn't want to be blonde or stacked or anything. You know, that I wanted to be wearing my dress, sitting at my table doing exactly what I was doing at that moment and at that time. I wanted to be me. I didn't want to trade places with anyone. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 72, when I couldn't even look in a mirror long enough to put makeup on, you couldn't have told me that that was going to happen. You know, it just doesn't happen, and yet it did. Today I have a job that I love very, very much, where I get out there and I practice law, and I'm able to be of service. And I work in criminal defense, and so I see a lot of the future members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I think will be joining us someday, and I see some of the past ones that aren't here with us right now. In law school, this guy asked me out that I didn't want to go out with because he'd never been in jail and he didn't have any tattoos. But I went out with him anyway. And we've been going out for 7.5 years now, and we got married last November. And and Cliff and Pat were at my wedding, and I walked down the aisle to When Irish Eyes Are Smiling. And there isn't anyone in the world who's ever had a wedding that I'd want to trade with. It was my wedding, and it was absolutely incredible, every moment of it. And I could have missed it all, and I would have. You know, there isn't any question. There are very few tough, dirty little Venice broads that I remember getting married the way that I got married last November. It rarely happens. And at that wedding, all of my family was there, from all over the different states in which they live. There was not one member of my family that I, you know, that I've ever known about that did not come, including two relatives that came from Canada that had never been to the United States to represent my grandparents. Now, I want to guarantee you that in 1972, and for, in fact, well over 5 years after I got sober, there wasn't anyone in my family that would have driven 5 miles to give me a ride. And I'm talking about after I got sober. And I was almost 10 years sober before I was ever given keys in my family, and there was a good reason for it. I had earned that reputation, you know. And they all made sure to be there, including ones who had never even met me, to represent, you know, other relatives on my family's side. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a taker. That's what I was. That is what I had always been. And I continued to be a taker even after I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was the only thing that I knew. And I don't know that it was so bad in some ways. I mean, I just kept showing up anyway. And I would go to meetings, you know, and I would try and take things from the meetings, you know, take the things I needed. And I would call people up and try and, you know, take things from them to help me get through the day, you know. And I would just take things all the time. And when I was at work, I would take pens, you know, because I knew they weren't paying me enough. And I would, you know, make long distance phone calls because I knew they weren't paying me enough. And I was just taking things, you know. And I would sit and I would hardly be able to enjoy a conversation with Vinoy because I'd be looking at her jewelry and thinking, I wish it was my jewelry, and how come I don't have that jewelry, and, you know, and just sort of, you know, couldn't even hear the things she was saying sometimes because I was just so interested in, where's mine? When am I going to get mine? How come I don't have nice things? How come I don't have a husband? How come I don't have, you know, these things? And then somewhere along the line, just from hanging out and listening to a lot of people share, I started to hear these things that they're talking about in the promises, you know, about where we can see where we can be of benefit to others, and we'll self-seeking will slip away, and just starting to try and show up and give things, you know. And I just started learning to do that. And the interesting thing is that through Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned to become a giver. And I don't mean to say that I don't still take and that I'm not selfish and I don't get petty and all those kind of things. But I'm learning here how to get out there and to give. And the fascinating thing is, and you're not going to believe it until you try it and you find out that it happens, the more you give, you get more than when you're trying to take to get what's yours. It just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, the more I try and give, the more I have. I don't even have enough time to enjoy all the things that I have now. You know, and out there when I was trying to take, I never had enough. And now I've got more than enough. I've got enough that I can share. And the more I keep sharing, the more I keep getting. And it absolutely doesn't make any sense. I have a relationship with my mother, and I'm just going to tell you about my family, and then I'm going to sit down, that is the best relationship that we have ever had. She is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had 11 years in December. It's not like Ozzie and Harriet, you know, with my mom and I, but it's the best relationship that we have ever had. This year, about 3 months ago, my 31-year-old cousin hung himself. And when he did, my aunt and uncle called me real early in the morning, and I got out there, and I just kind of stayed with him. And we don't know why. I wish, in a sense, you know, that he'd been an alcoholic, that we could say, you know, he was one of those. But there isn't any reason that we know about. He left a wife and 4 kids. And here is this guy, this kid that's 1 year older than I am, that I grew up with, that, as far as any of us know, never tried to kill himself. And I tried over and over and over and over, you know. And he just tried once. And my uncle doesn't even believe he really meant it, you know, to work. Just a series of bad breaks there, you know. And they called, and I was able to be there. And they kept saying to me, "We can't believe, you know, all the things that you're doing, and that you're just here." I just kept taking care of things, just like I was taught to do in AA. You know, there isn't anything I could do. I just made spaghetti, you know, for 20 people. You know, and I just go to the store when I saw they were running low on soda pops or whatever it was. You know, and just those kind of things that I learned to do here in AA, so that I could just kind of be there. It doesn't take their pain away. There isn't anything that takes that kind of pain away. I have a 67-year-old uncle who never expected to have to bury his 31-year-old son, you know, but just that I could be able to be there, because he taught me to be able to give, you know, and I don't know how those kind of things happen here, but they do. I have the best life that I have ever had. I'm the best person that I have ever been. I live a life I never wanted any part of, and I'm a person I wouldn't have even liked when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new, stick around so the same things can happen to you. Thanks for inviting me.